Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Christina Clack, and I'm happy to be your presider today. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome all people, regardless of their age or their abilities or their family structures. We will have some time at the end of the service for new guests or visitors to introduce yourselves, and we would really love for you to do that. It is not required. The program committee at Prairie works hard to offer a wide variety of programming. We have guest speakers from the wider community, from our own congregation, and of course, programs by our minister, Sandy Ingham. Today, I am thrilled to say we have Robin Proud. I'll say a few more words about her before her program, but I've been looking forward to this for many, many months. Robin does a fabulous job. You're just gonna love her program, so.
Our opening words from Julia Ward Howe. God forgive me if I do wrong in following with ardor the strongest instincts of my nature.
Our chalice lighting today will be done by Nevena Smith.
And
Mary.
I like the candle.
It's a little long today and a little depressing, but I'll try not to. All right. We light this flame for the victims of human and natural catastrophes around the world, for those bent under the burden of AIDS, the stigma of disease, and the lack of understanding of those close to them, neighbors, and family members, for victims of famine, among them the many children with shrunken bodies and eyes that don't know where to look for help, for those injured by the breach of couples, especially the children, for refugees and those displaced by countless wars that ravage so many regions of our world and who are left to stand on the doorstep of despair, for victims of the errors brought about by human whims and caprices, of which global warming is but one symptom. We light this flame also as a sign of our gratitude for all the love, care, and solidarity of which women and men are capable in the face of such terrible tragedies. Fulgence, and I'm gonna attempt this, Ndagijimana, submitted by the Assemblée des Chrétiens Unitariens in Burundi.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Robin Proud for her program today. Robin has been a UU for almost 40 years and has spoken in numerous UU societies in Minnesota and Wisconsin. This is the latest installment in her series, Famous UU Women You've Barely Heard Of.
So here's Julia Ward Howe at a fairly young age. Some of the pictures you see of her are from her older time when she looked a lot like Queen Victoria. Well, most people do know a little something about Julia Ward Howe. The two things that people have generally heard of are that she wrote the lyrics for the Battle Hymn of the Republic and that she instituted an early form of Mother's Day. So from those two achievements, you might assume that she was a typical example of 19th century domesticity, that she was patriotic and supporting the wife as the angel of the home for her husband and children. So you might assume those things, but you would be very wrong. Julia Ward Howe was a radical, free-thinking, independent, creative individual who struggled her whole life against restraints, first of her strict father, then her demanding husband, and then society at large. Now, Julia's background was quite different from the other women that I've researched. I've done talks on six or seven women, and mostly they were from very poor backgrounds. They had to support themselves and their families. Julia was a society girl. Her father was a banker in New York City. On one side, she was descended from Roger Williams, and the other side from Frances Marion the Swamp Fox. One of her brothers married an Astor, so they were in high society. However, when Julia was only five, her mother died in childbirth, and her father, who was already rather conservative in his Christian views, became even more so. He forbade his daughter to attend theater or concerts. He pretty much secluded her at home, even though her older brothers were allowed to go out. And he emphasized the seriousness of her position as the eldest Miss Ward. For instance, when she was 9, he ordered that her dolls be taken away because she needed to be serious. Now, this was not a big trauma for her because her favorite thing to do really was to read and study and write. From an early age, she loved most to write poetry. One of her daughters later said, "From her earliest childhood, Julia Ward's need of expressing herself in verse was imperative. Every emotion must take metrical shape. And she herself wrote that she had a vision of some great work which I myself should give the world. I would write the novel or play of the age." Now, this is remarkable because at the time, women authors were very rare. When Julia was 20 and her father died after a short illness, and a brother died soon after, rather than taking advantage of her freedom, she for a while retreated into a more strict vision of religion herself. Her brothers changed her nickname from Jolly Julie to Old Bird, which they called her for the rest of her life. So this was her chance for a bit of freedom, but at first she still buried herself in abstention. But during her 2-year period of mourning, she read a lot in the books that her brothers had, which included many European works. And she came to a more loving view of God and a more freeing view of herself. So when it was time for her to enter society, she did so with pleasure and to great acclaim. She and her younger sisters were called the Three Graces of Bond Street, and Julia was acknowledged the most beautiful. She was introduced to the cream of society in New York and Boston. In Boston in 1841, she visited the Perkins Institution run by Samuel Gridley Howe. Now, he was quite a romantic figure in his own right. After receiving a medical degree from Harvard, he volunteered as a surgeon in the Greek War of Independence. So this put him on a par with the famous Lord Byron, and apparently he had the looks to match. He was famed for his black hair, blue eyes, and his excellent figure on horseback. Because of this image and the recognition he had received in Greece, his friends called him Chevalier, or Chev for short, and this was the name that he went by for the rest of his life. And when he returned from Greece, he set himself up to work with the blind, who at the time most people considered feeble-minded, thought there was no point in trying to teach them. At the Perkins Institution, he developed many methods, and he even worked with a girl named Laura Bridgman, who was both blind and deaf, developing the methods that were later to revolutionize the life of Helen Keller. So he was very admirable. Julia found him fascinating, and he found her fascinating as well. Within a year, they were engaged. There were some warning signs about this match. Howe was 18 years older than Julia, so could it be she was trying to replace her father? He was a demanding man, running his institute with personal attention to every detail. He resented Julia's money and insisted that he take control of it, and he was adamant that a woman's place was in the home. He admired her poetry, but he assumed that she would never publish or speak in public. And he wrote her enthusiastic love letters, but here this was included in one of them. "I give you fair warning. I shall not help you out of the cocoon state at all. You are a sweet, pretty little mortal and shall not be immortal if I can help it this many a long year. I suppose you think you would look very beautifully emerging from the chrysalis state, and that I should be proud to see a pair of wings sprouting out from your white shoulders. But no such thing, and I advise you not to show even a feather, for I shall unmercifully cut them off to keep you prisoner in my arms, my own dear earthly wife." So this was a love letter he wrote. Now it could be that Julia and Chev were like many of us. They thought that the other person would mellow with time. He was sure that marriage and motherhood would tame her spirit, and she thought that love and patience would wear down his resistance to her wishes. Unfortunately, they were both wrong. Their marriage started well enough. They took a honeymoon trip to Europe accompanied by Julia's sister Annie and also another newlywed pair, Horace and Mary Peabody Mann, who you might remember from one of my other talks. Julia's letters were happy at first, but her poetry from the time depicts some sad and morbid images. So they traveled to London, where they met many celebrities. They moved on to Switzerland, Austria, and Italy, where their first child was born. And this girl was named Julia Romana, after the city of Rome. Julia's letters from this time and from the births of later children seem to show that she suffered from postpartum depression. And in addition, she always feared childbirth because that was how how her mother had died. Now Shev thought the whole point of childbirth was glorious. He wrote to his friend Charles Sumner, the famous abolitionist, "No true woman ever considered it a burden to bear an infant." And he insisted that his wife had been transformed from a New York belle to a domestic goddess. And he discoursed on how the pains of labor were seeds of beautiful and ennobling affections. Well, his views, to be fair, reflected the Victorian ideal of the woman as the goddess or angel within the sphere of the home. Ironically, Shev himself was a persistent hypochondriac whose mysterious symptoms demanded the attention of his already beleaguered wife. Now, if they had lived in New York or Boston, Julia would have at least had a few outlets, but they were living at the Institute, which was outside of a small town, and she was just as isolated as she had been in her father's home. He worked long hours and expected her to be content, and he was totally opposed to her publishing or having any outside role. She was still young and had barely begun to enjoy society. Now, they were both strong personalities. Her family called her Diva Julia. She needed a lot of attention and emotional outlets, which Shev couldn't provide or even understand. Julia's housekeeping skills were minimal, and she had had little experience supervising servants who came and went with discouraging frequency. But most of all, Julia felt that she was not able to express the passion that she had for writing. She wrote to her sister Louisa, "My voice is frozen to silence, my poetry chained down by an icy bond of indifference." Julia's letters throughout her marriage reveal anger, bitterness, fear, and guilt. She wanted to convince others and herself that she was happy, but she and Shev were caught in a constant cycle of argument, frustration, and misunderstanding. She wrote in another letter, "God knows one's wedding day may be worse than the day of one's death. One's husband may prove anything but a comfort and support." She still hoped to change Shev. "He must learn to understand those things which have entirely formed my character. I have come to him, have left my poetry, my music, my religion, have walked with him in his cold world of actualities. There I have learned much, but there I can do nothing. He must come to me, must have ears for my music, must have a soul for my faith. In my nature is to sing, to pray, to feel. His is to fight, to teach, to reason." Sounds a bit like the Mars and Venus, right? But for his part, Shev was only echoing the expectations of the time. And the couple had 4 children in 6 years, and then 1 4 years later, and another 5 years after that. So between the ages of 24 and 40, Julia was pretty much having and raising children. Now, her children, when they were grown, wrote a laudatory and prize-winning biography of their mother, and they avoided any mentions of marital discord, but they did confide, before the birth of each successive child, she was oppressed by a deep and persistent melancholy. And there is one quote here, how she felt about being pregnant. "When the unwelcome little unborn shall have seen the light, my brain will be lightened, and I shall have a clearer mind. Thank God that even this weary 9 months shall come to an end, and leave me in possession of my own body and my own soul." Julia's children carefully groomed their domestic history for public consumption later, and we've seen this with a number of the other women that I've talked about, Louisa May Alcott or Margaret Fuller, that later in the Victorian era, their independence and their originality was toned down. And they did have some good times as a family, putting on plays, and certainly the children admired their parents' devotion to social causes. However, one thing that was totally hushed up was the fact that Julia and Shev separated for almost a year in 1850. Julia's sister Louisa had married a sculptor and was living in Rome. Shev took a 6-month leave to accompany Julia on a visit with their 2 youngest children at the time, Harry and Laura, leaving the 2 older children in the care of friends. Well, Julia stayed on after Shev left for almost a year. We know little about this time. Her letters to and from Shev were apparently so troubling that he asked her to burn them. So we don't know whether she wanted to come home and he refused to receive her until she met his demands, or whether he wanted her to return and she was refusing. In the ensuing years, apparently Shev repeatedly asked for a divorce, but he demanded to keep his 2 favorite children, Julia Romana, who was the oldest, and Harry, the son, which their mother would never agree to. And that Roman sojourn split up the family. The two older ones who had stayed at home with their father tended to take his part. The two younger ones were very close to each other and often took their mother's part. Well, in December 1853, Julia published a book of poems entitled Passion Flowers. It was published anonymously, but apparently there were enough clues for readers in the Boston circles to identify its author. There were also a number of allusions to Julia's disappointments in marriage. Chev was furious. Julia wrote that he was cold and indifferent to her. Although this did not stop him from again getting her with child. At this point, a public separation or divorce would have been a huge scandal, and neither was willing to give up any of the children. Thwarted in her poetic endeavors, Julia threw herself into a cause that she shared with Chev and most of their acquaintances, which was abolition. They were close friends of Charles Sumner, and Chev may have been one of the secret six who financed John Brown. During the Civil War, they served on the Sanitary Commission, and this was an entity greatly needed because more men died of infection and disease during the Civil War than from the actual wounds themselves. On a trip to Washington, D.C. in this capacity, with their Unitarian minister, Reverend James Freeman Clark, Julia and her companion sang some popular songs with the soldiers, including John Brown's Body. Clark suggested that Julia write some more uplifting words to the tune than John Brown's Body Lies Moldering in the Grave, which was what they were singing. So that night, she later recalled, "I awoke in the gray of morning twilight, and the long lines of the desired poem began to form themselves in my mind." She jumped out of bed and scrawled the verses on a loose piece of paper. When she awoke, she could not remember the words, but there on the paper she found six stanzas. They were published 2 months later in the Atlantic Monthly, which that's delightful, we still read that today. The song's biblical and apocalyptic imagery made it a perfect fit with the messianic mission that the North wanted its soldiers and civilians to support. Julia was instantly famous across the country, and even Chev could accept this sort of poetry. So we can't talk about the Battle Hymn of the Republic without singing it, because otherwise you'll have it stuck in your head, as I have for the past 2 months working on this. But the fact that she wrote it down in that method does explain if there are any metaphors that don't quite make total sense in the song, that could be why, because she wrote this in this state. Apparently she often wrote poetry in that way, but most of that has not survived. So we can sing the four verses that you have on your sheet. Wonderful, and thank you, Mary. After this, Julia was much in demand to speak and to read her poetry. Chev was still opposed, but personal tragedy helped push Julia into the public. In May of 1863, her young son Sammy died of diphtheria. Both parents were distraught, but grieved in different ways. And again, this is something we can relate to. Chev refused to ride with the body to the funeral and did not want to talk about him. He found it painful. Well, Julia wanted to ride with her son's body as a last opportunity to be with him, and she wanted to speak of him constantly. So this was another conflict that they had. Her only escape was in her studies and writing, and especially when she had the opportunity to read her papers to an audience. Chev never approved, and he insisted that, of course, she never take any compensation. Well, in 1864, Julia traveled to Washington again, this time to deliver a series of lectures. Not only did Chev disapprove, and her children who were now growing up, but their friend Charles Sumner, who told her no one in Washington wanted to hear her. Julia said, "I go in obedience to a deep and strong impulse, which I do not understand or explain, but whose bidding I cannot neglect. The satisfaction of having at last obeyed this interior guide is all that keeps me up, for no one, so far as I know, altogether approves of my going." Apparently, the lectures were a success, but on her return, Chev punished her by refusing to hear about the trip and stressing how much her absence had pained the family. In November 1864, she was invited to New York to read a poem in the company of Oliver Wendell Holmes and Ralph Waldo Emerson. She said, "I read well, yet Chev was much opposed to my going, and no one in the family celebrated what she called the greatest public honor of my life." She recorded the experience in her diary for the sake of her grandchildren, who she hoped would someday live in a more enlightened time. With her children growing up, and with her abandoning any hope of changing her husband's opinions, Julia formally joined the women's suffrage movement in 1868. Well, Shev's complaints about the movement and the women in it sound a lot like what some of us have heard in the 1970s and since. He thought that the women were out to subjugate men, abandon their children, and that they were just getting together to enjoy frivolous evenings out. Well, one area where Shev and Julia could still work together was for international peace. In the Civil War, she had the same conflict as many of the Unitarians, that she was opposed to war in general, but felt that slavery was so terrible that perhaps war was justified. But in 1870, as Europe was struggling through the Franco-Prussian War, she called for mothers around the world to join in a mighty and august Congress. She felt that all mothers are naturally supporters of peace, wanting to keep their children safe from being killed or from killing. The event, the Mother's Day for Peace, never actually happened, and when Mother's Day was later revived, it was in a more domestic context. But we do have in the back of our hymnal, there is an excerpt from what she wrote, "Arise, Mothers of the World," something like that. As the 1870s progressed, Shev's health steadily declined. So remember, he was 18 years older than Julia. Shortly before his death in January 1876, he confessed to Julia that he, the champion of traditional domestic happiness, had been unfaithful to her, seemingly more than once. This fact, as well as most of the conflicts between Julia and Shev, was kept secret throughout her life, and even well afterwards. Julia's daughters wrote a biography that actually won a Pulitzer Prize, but they featured their happy home with devoted and unified parents, and they burned letters and journals that did not support this happy view. But apparently there was enough remaining for scholars to uncover this. The day after Shev's death, Julia, who was in her 50s, wrote in her journal, "My new life begins today." So this is the part that some of you may be more familiar with, so I will just briefly mention some of the many projects that Julia undertook. Finally free to travel, to write and speak as she desired, she lectured on a variety of subjects. She used the fees to support herself. As it turned out, Shev had mismanaged her fortune, and a male cousin had managed to lose the rest. She preached regularly at both Unitarian and Universalist churches. Beginning in 1873, she hosted an annual gathering of women ministers. So I was thinking of the presentations that Sandy has been giving on them. And in the 1870s, she helped found the Free Religious Association. In 1879, she published an article in the North American Review, and it was in response to an earlier article. The famous historian Frances Parkman had written about why women's suffrage was unnecessary. And she had a number of excellent responses, but for instance, the husband represents his wife. Well, that was supposed to be the case for slavery as well, but it was clear that the slave owner was not representing the interests of the slave. And one that I liked was, "Why should one sex assume to legislate for both? Because it has always done so? Because women have already possessed political power and have abused it? This argument can be used with triple force against the other sex." She traveled to Europe and the Middle East. She published a biography of Margaret Fuller. And in 1889, she helped to bring about the merger of the American Woman's Suffrage Association with a rival organization led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, thus forming the National American Woman's Suffrage Association. She was a founder of multiple women's organizations, including, in 1876, the Wisconsin Women's Club. She was editor and writer for the magazine Women's Journal for 20 years. She continued to write poetry and published her memoirs in 1899. In 1893, Julia, well-known and sometimes called the Queen of America, and at this point she actually resembled a bit her contemporary Queen Victoria, they were born in the same year, actually, Julia participated in the Chicago Columbian Exposition, or World's Fair, and she spoke on what is religion, and included the following. "I think nothing is religion which puts one individual absolutely above others. And surely nothing is religion which puts one sex above another. Any religion which will sacrifice a certain set of human beings for the enjoyment or aggrandizement or advantage of another is no religion. It is a thing which may be allowed, but it is against true religion. Any religion which sacrifices women to the brutality of men is no religion." Interestingly, Jimmy Carter has just written a book with the same theme. When Julia died in 1910, 4,000 people attended her memorial service, where Samuel G. Eliot, head of the American Unitarian Association, gave the eulogy. So she had lived to 90 years. Julia Ward Howe's public accomplishments are many and admirable, but what most inspires me about her is her determination to follow her passion and her gifts. She did this even when her family, her husband, and all of society not only failed to support her, but actively opposed her. She was always confident that the most important thing was to listen to that inner voice that compelled her to speak up and to be heard. Well, I don't have an answer to that. And in her case, she seemed to always have this inner drive that she was absolutely sure. And we've heard people who are writers, for instance, or artists say that they are just driven to do whatever it is. A couple of the other women, it was because they had been educated by their fathers and took that as a role model, even though other women in society were not acting that way. But yeah, certainly there was nothing in Julia's home life. Her mother actually was a writer of poetry, but because her mother died when she was 5, she didn't have much direct influence. So we don't know what that was that really drove her to know that she had something to give to the world. Good question. The excerpt that I read about true religion could not be anything where one group is superior to another. She did have more in that vein, and also that religion around the world was more alike than different, so she did have more of a universalist view, mm-hmm. and which was true of many of the women that I researched, and more that they learned about and traveled. So she did write on a number of different political and social topics. Yes, and actually you can find, I mean, a lot of her writing is on, because she was famous, is on the internet, were published, and some of it seems a bit flowery because it was talking about social issues. Yeah, my understanding is that she didn't write about her personal conflicts, that was unearthed later from letters and so on. And I had thought that where it says, "Be jubilant, my feet," was supposed to be "as we go marching on," but apparently she wrote God in all those verses, so that was just what was expected. And it's called a hymn, so that makes sense. But the language of it, "mine eyes," the very biblical sound of it, and of course we do have several things. We have quotations taken from their books named The Grapes of Wrath. There's also a book named In the Beauty of the Lilies, so there's a lot of quotes that come from there. And it was a song when I was years ago studying in France. It was like these European kids all knew this, or at least they knew the chorus and maybe had other words to it, so that was something that on the bus these young people from Switzerland and Finland and other places knew that "Glory, Glory, Hallelujah" chorus.
Thank you so much, Robin. That was excellent,
as usual.
Thank you. And Robin will read our closing words.
All right, from Julia Ward Howe. "I shall stick to my resolution of writing always what I think, no matter whom it offends."
And with those words, please stay for coffee. And remember, we have a parish meeting and a soup Sunday today. So we're going to be setting lunch out. So please stay and enjoy.